Did you collect things from the countryside? Nuts, fruit? You said
Oh,
about the cowslips.
cowslips. Well, we, oh, blackberries, of course. I mean, that was a traditional thing. But you didn't pick over there because that was old Mrs. So-and-so's, and she was, that was her hedge or hedges. Not that they were here, her hedges, actually, but those were where she always got her. Well, she obviously picked enough to make the jam that she needed, and picking blackberries was considered, oh well, people used to pick blackberries and take them to the village shop, where they'd be sent to the jam factories, probably down in Essex, I don't know, Goldhanger Fruit Farms or whatever. So it was that.
Did you trap rabbits?
Well, we didn't, but what we did do was to go at harvest time, follow the binder from field to field, and then some of us boys used to actually follow the binder around as it went round, and some always stood in where they thought was where the rabbits would come out, you see. And we used to get one or two every now and again. And my aunt, who was a domestic science teacher and she knew about these things, did the skinning of the rabbit and dressing it ready for cooking. So I was never somebody who used a shotgun. I think I've pulled the trigger a couple of times on. I can remember one time, and I don't know where the rabbit went, but I know these guns are horribly noisy, and it's not surprising that you see a lot of elderly farmers or people who do a lot, who used to do a lot of shooting. Their hearing isn't too good.
Were other animals or birds hunted in the valley?
Oh well, there was some the shoots, of course, the gamekeepers, you have the, who reared the reared pheasants and partridges to release, and they're usually released in woods or coverts, so that they could be. Oh, I can't think of the term now, but anyway, they were driven so that there were one or two quite well-known ones in on the estate. One was from Redgrave over the valley towards Botterstail, where it comes down fairly steep, and then you've got trees at the bottom, so that encouraged the pheasants to fly high, and that's what the sportsmen like. They like them high, flying high, so that, gives it's a bit more of a challenge. Then, of course, the gamekeeper used to shoot stoats, weasels. Certainly, jays and magpies definitely. And you used to see them in certain places, hung up on a wire fence or beside a gateway, especially where the gamekeeper knew the squire would be travelling through in his Land Rover. So, let the squire know that he'd been doing his job. There were hunts that came in the area, but it wasn't a real hunting area, although, as I say, sometimes you occasionally got the hunt coming through. And then there was a time when they used to hunt deer, and they used to be taken out, released, and then hunted. And I can remember one of the blokes one of the farms I worked on, Hall Farm, Redgrave. Yeah, so Vic Matthews, there was a hunt. They were hunting this stag, I suppose it was, and it came off the off Redgrave Park into what are known as bullock sheds, which were a range of buildings with yards and so on. And sheds and so on, and it got in there, and there were loose boxes as well, and the hunt was some way behind, coming up behind, and Vic managed to get this creature into one of the loose boxes, and so when the hunt came, they said, "Oh, have you seen the stag?" And yes, Vic said, "Oh yes, yes. Oh, which way did it go?" He pointed his thumb and off they went. And then a little bit later, they let the creature go. And there was quite a lot of poaching going on. But of course, people had to be a bit careful, because your job might go if you were a farm worker and you were caught. And you were working for the squire and you poached his birds, and I can always remember one farm worker, one of the tractor drivers. We were walking down the side of a muddy track, and he carefully avoided walking through a puddle. He went round, you know, it's on the sort of rough and not very comfortable walking side to the track. I avoided walking there. I said, "Well, you know, why are you doing that?" He said, "Well, I usually walking straight on." He said, "I'll leave my footprints there." And I thought, "Oh yes, well, Ollie must do." So. There's a certain amount of, and that sort of poaching was, as I say, for the pot, not this sort of poaching that goes on these days when people come up and, especially on the bigger estates where there's a lot of birds all together and they just try and get as many as they can. It was just going off and having a bit more protein in their diet, I think. But there was, oh yes, and then of course there was this what do you call it? Old Wop Garnham, who would say, "I know who they are, I know who they are. I'll get them. And he was always going to get them, which was interesting. But, no, Wop was quite a character. At the end of his time as a gamekeeper, when the gamekeepers being cut down and down and down, he had from Birgit right the way through to Hinderclay Wood, almost to Watersfield, as part of his patch. So and probably before breakfast he'd have in the summer he would have walked quite a number of miles. And in the early days they used to do a lot of the rearing, if not all the rearing, on the broody hens. Then they started getting incubators and so on, and I think buying in Dales, like Dale chicks. And then he used to collect eggs in the hedgerows so that so they could be hatched and off, and that would presumably encourage the wild wild hen to produce some more eggs. Partridges, there weren't so many, there never have been very many, but now as far as badgers are concerned, I had never seen any sign of a badger until relatively recently, last 10-15 years. And it was actually when I was working on land I hadn't worked on before. And that's sort of in the Ricking Horse Superior and Watersfield area. And where, whether they had been in the area earlier or not, I don't know, but or whether they've spread in the area, they've spread to different territories, I don't know.
Do you remember the Little Ouse being flooded?
Well, I can remember the tributary in the famous 1968 floods, September floods, when yes, there were quite a lot of local people went up for that, up to Bury St Edmunds on the Sunday evening, having an evening out, and they got back as far as Snape Hill, got over the top of Snape Hill, and that's where they got to. They couldn't get down to go through Ricking Hall. It was flooded, and it was when the road between Redgrave and Botterstail was flooded, and at the time I was doing relief farm work, and I was working down in Fen Street in Redgrave, and I can remember being met by the foreman when I nearly got to the farm, who said he was there with a tractor, an old Nuffield. It was for the time it was a big tractor, so it was, well, you know, it was just the thing to get through floods. And so Robin, the foreman, stopped me and said, "You won't be able to get through there with your mini. I'll give you a lift with the tractor." And that afternoon, he took one of the other people who were working there back home, and there's the river which flows, as I mentioned before, from the lake and so on, and joins the Little Ouse between Redgrave and Hinderclay. And there's a arch, or there used to be a humpback bridge near where, I forget what they call themselves now, the duck factory, or, you know, poultry people, It used to be buttons, stucks in those days. And the bridge was known as Crackthorn Arch. Anyway, Robin, who was a bit of harum scarum sort of type, he went charging down there, taking his chap back home in the firm's pickup, mini pickup. And he hit the water, one side of the bridge, and then drove up onto the bridge where he was out of the water and literally took off and plonked down into the water the other side and floated down the road. So that's the only sort of real experience. I can remember the, whatchamacallit, the Ford, well, two Fords actually, we used to call them water splashes. There was one between Redgrave and it was actually in South Lopham, but it was on the Redgrave Road, and that was before it was properly bridged. And then of course the little ooze between Blownorton and Thelneath and near the windmill, but my memories of the valleys flooding was mainly the Waveney Valley. Yes, I can remember wandering around on these. I can remember fires on Redgrave Fen, but in the Little Ouse Valley, it's mainly seeing the results of fires where there had been, especially when I started getting interested in. With the Suffolk Wildlife Trust, or the Suffolk Trust for Nature Conservation, as I think it was then called, when we were sort of looking around other fens, and there were, and this is what you got quite often on these fens, was signs of fires which had taken place within the last 2 or 3 years, and that I think helped to keep the spread of scrub down considerably. And of course, I think that's frowned upon now, but I think it probably had its uses. But and then of course that used to be one of the things when sedge and reeds were mown, particularly sedge. There were some areas which was just no good for sedge as a crop, and so they would be left. And then after the harvest, or after the winter, when the water levels were high, water tables, then they'd be burnt off. So there was fire was used as a management tool, as it were, but fire and water, yes. So
do you remember anyone digging peat?
No. But I can remember a peat digger's spade, which hung in one of the outbuildings at the rectory, because we went to live in the rectory for a while. And there was this curious looking implement. A spade with a knife, as it were, at right angles, so that when you cut a block of peat, I don't know what you did with the first one, but once you got an edge, and then you could dig, and each time you moved along, and that would, because you only need two bits to be cut through, if you can imagine cutting a strip of peat. So that was the sort of implement they used in the fens around here. In other places they used slightly different methods. Mm. I think it's like, and so had different shaped tools, and it would be different, the nature of the peat, the nature of the fens, the nature of the bog. They would demand a different, slightly different implement. It's like bill hooks. You've got the one which is typical of this area. And then you get these things called a Yorkshire bill hook, which the conservation corps and conservation bodies all got very excited about and thought this was a wonderful thing because you could use it like that and like this and like that because of the different... because of the blades and the shape of the blade and this and that and the next thing, but no. They might have been useful for certain jobs in Yorkshire and it got the name in the trade as the manufacturers would call them as a Yorkshire billhook, but somehow that got into the heavy and awkward to use, but the Suffolk billhook was very much lighter, and you could see, and it was obviously the sort of thing which would be used for coppicing, light to handle and all the rest of it, and the way that it was designed so that you could the fact that he had a sort of hook at one end, you could either hook that round and pull, or the other side of the hook, there was a little spike which you could... it's not very easy to draw my pictures and let you hear what I'm saying, drawing. But it could be used to... if you think of a coppiced bit of hazel with a lot of fairly thin and whippy shoots coming up, and you could get an individual one by pushing it over if you wanted to with a bill hook, and then you could pull it over with the other hand and into a position so you could chop it down. That isn't very...
Do you remember any unusual birds in the valley?
Well, one thing which... It's interesting, this... The nightingales, the way the nightingales have the numbers have been decimated, and my mum always used to say she could hear the nightingales singing in the red grape shrubbery, which was behind the hall. Shrubbery's still there, but of course the hall's gone. And of course that was the time when I was being at boarding school. I never heard those. The only time I can remember as a child, we are coming to Little Lou's side now, a bit further down than our area, but I can remember being driven along the road, the far side of Riddlesworth on the A1066. Trees, a bit of woodland, obviously being coppiced in its time, and it was driving along in a Rolls Royce convertible, hood down, And you know, Rolls Royces, you can hardly hear the engine. But being driven along there and hearing nightingales in that strip. In more recent years, I've heard them at Nettleshall Heath. In fact, Mum and I used to go out and drive round. We never went before 11 o'clock. Or we might start off before 11 o'clock, because there's a silent hour when nightingales don't sing. They've got a trades union, you knew that, didn't you? And they don't, they've got to have their 1 hour off. And it, you know, it's surprising how regular it is. And if you get just after that time, then they really sort of go at hammer and tongs. And I can remember, this is going back, 70s, 80s. We'd make a trip round, we'd go down to the Redgrave Lopham Road, to the, near the sources, and we'd hear nightingales there. We might go up to around Redgrave Fen and hear them there. And then one of the favourite places was Market Weston Fen, which of course is on the edge of Hopton, the village of Hopton. And one or two other places. So that was one of the birds which... and then in Redgrave, there was one quite near the fen, Redgrave Fen. There was a little, you know, patch where
you could... Did you hear snipes drumming?
Oh, snipe drumming, yes. I've seen snipe in 10s, 20s, 30s, occasionally, down between Redgrave and Bottesdale. There were a whole lot of... I mean, this is something which, in the late 60s, early 70s, there was I don't know if you were around there in that time, but there was a fire. That was when the estate was being sold off, and quite a lot of the land in Redgrave and Hinderclay, Rickinghall, Bottesdale had been sold, and by a farmer who'd made his money by mining in the Peak District, what's it called? Limestone. And that's where he made his money. He hadn't made it farming. And he came down and he was going to show the, you know, how farming should be done, this, that, the next thing, or I don't know. Anyway, he really destroyed the countryside around Redgrave. In fact, I've got some maps, which I did, of land stretching from Hinderclay into Redgrave, where there's been fields, dozens of fields, literally put into just a few big ones. In fact, there's one in Redgrave, I counted up 25 separate fields, 200 acres odd, I suppose. Then what happens after a year or two, you see there's where the old footpath used to run, they don't plough it anymore now, they've left it to but for the first year or two. But the thing was that down at the bottom of those meadows, it was total destruction. I just couldn't go down there. It was years before I could bring myself to go down there, because it upset me so much to go there. So,
and that's where the snipe were.
And the snipe, yes, they would have been on the damper meadows and so on. And also, I think some of those meadows used to be used by things like the zebras. Now, your eyebrows jump up, and yes, it was some circus. I don't know which circus. It was one of the famous circuses. Used to bring some of their animals up to Ricking Hall or Botterstowe, in the off season. And apparently, so you got, so I am told, by a resident of Eye who used to live in Botterstowe. No, it was on those meadows between the two, Redgrave, Botterstowe, Redgrave, Ricking Hall, that sort of area, where I saw. And then Peewits, yes, they were. You would expect to see Peewits flying around in the springtime, nesting somewhere, and you'd get the odd pair and doing their display flights and whitting around. And yes, I've got one or two bird calls I occasionally call up. And yes, anyway, and then in the autumn you used to get them in flocks with golden plover. And they were regular. I mean, the last time I can really, I think I actually took a few shots on Cine, and that was between Hinderclay and Thelneatham. It was on the side of the road, and there they were, and they were there a few days later when I came with a camera. I don't know what happened to that bit of film. And you don't think that this is something, I mean, at the time I thought that was a sort of, I'd be seeing, well, I didn't, I wouldn't have thought, well, I'm not going to see this for very much longer. But there are, it's, and another thing is skylarks. I can remember going out with a sound recording, with a tape recording, recorder, and a parabolic reflector. Going to record birdsong and going down from the village of Redgrave, and there was a certain spot where I knew I'd hear skylarks, and there would be other places as well, but there was one good place. But a few years later, no, the numbers had gone down and down and down and down. Cuckoos, that's another thing. I've recorded cuckoos on Thelneatham and Blow Norton Fens. And this was on Blow Norton Fen before it was a reserve of any sort or managed by. I mean, it was before the Little Ooze, whatchamacallit, Project, Headwaters Project. Well, it was before. The people who got that project going were even in the area. I was dodging around, playing around there. And again, that's where I can remember, I was talking about seeing bits of Fenway which had a fire. And, I mean, there are stories of people, to be quite blunt about it, arson. It used to happen. I know it was also, as I say, it was also a method of management. But there is a lovely story of somebody who used to go down from Redgrave. He'd go into up to South Lopham to the White Horse, and every now and again he'd go out of the bar and look out and look down towards Redgrave, and then eventually he'd say, "Oh, look, there's a fire down there." Well, why did he think? Why did he go out there to look for it? And there was this tradition. Yes, this is a tradition of, or so it seems, that the fen would be set on fire. And I can remember my mum telling me about what grandfather used to say. When people said, "I wonder why it's always on the Redgrave side that the fires were," and my grandfather's reply was, "They were a much more badly behaved lot on the Redgrave side, but if you think of it, Redgrave, there's a lot more people around it and close to the fen than there is in Lopham." Well, I should think that was more to do with it. And there was a series of letters to the Dis Express a few months ago about, and I think in one of the letters they were talking about, I don't know what, there was a mention of the, I'm sure there was a mention of fires and the mention of Tom Driver. Now, again, he's dead and gone some time ago, but he was, they sort of, they was out saying that it was he who set the fen afire, and he lived down by the, well, just off Fen Street, so you never know, it might have been the Tom Driver who's whose younger brother was Albert Driver, who used to be a very famous bell ringer. Ah, that's something, yes. That reminds me, I think of bell ringing, and I immediately thought, I don't know why, I think it was probably because I went with my brother when he was recording various bell ringers, or various people ringing bells at various churches, and one was at Blow Norton. And I thought, oh yes, Blow Norton. You've got, there's, and I heard that, I'd gathered that, the Black Prince, as he was called, was buried there. He was Frederick, or Freddie, they called him, I think, in the family, Julep Singh of Elverdon Hall. He was one of the sons of the original Raja Marja. And if you look in the churchyard, you just need to look at the headstones, and there it is. It stands out because it's got a very much in the style of an Indian. It isn't a Christian headstone. It's very much in that style, and that's where the Black Prince, who lived at Blow Norton Hall, so presumably some of the people who'll be talking to you lot will hear about. I'm sure what's her name, Karen, will be hearing a lot about the Black Prince, as he was known. And he was somebody that my grandfather used to shoot with. You know, or they'd be on the same shooting parties. And in fact, the Wilson family sold Much of the Elverton estate, or shall I say, the part of the Elverton estate which was actually in Wangford parish, because the family owned the whole of the Wangford parish, a parish, except for the glebe land, the church and glebe land. But it was sort of absolutely no good to anybody, they thought, in those days, until the Forestry Commission came along, and the Elverton estate leased the land to the Forestry Commission. So anyway, that's another link with history in a wider sphere. But
perhaps this is a good moment to stop then.
Right, we'll stop with Freddie.